Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA, LPFM, Portsmouth Community Radio. My name is Steve Diamond. Today is October 8th, 2005. And in this week's show, we'll be focusing on insiders who became whistleblowers. We'll be hearing from some of the many recent military insiders who have become disillusioned and are now speaking out forcefully against the occupation of Iraq and for the basic principles they thought they were fighting for. We'll start off with parts of an audio collage of some recent voices in the news, including McCain, Rumsfeld, Bush, DeLay, and others, compiled by Joe Broadhurst of Zapping the Empire. We'll then hear excerpts from the recent Citizens Tribunal on Iraq, followed by highlights from the United for Peace and Justice concert that happened at the anti-war demonstration in Washington, D.C. on September 24th. First, some news. All Things Considered has reported that Acting FEMA Director David Paulison has said that FEMA will review the no-bid contracts worth millions of dollars that were awarded in the immediate aftermath of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. And from the Associated Press, U.S. GIs seek to retake western Iraqi towns. U.S. troops pushed through streets sown with bombs Tuesday in their biggest operation this year in western Iraq, seeking to retake three Euphrates River towns. At least five U.S. service members have been killed in the fighting. This operation, launched at the start of the holy month of Ramadan, was the second U.S. offensive in a week in Anbar province near the Syrian border. Al-Qaeda in Iraq called for intensified attacks on U.S. and Iraqi forces during the Muslim period of fasting. Blasts from U.S. warplanes and helicopters lit up the sky during the fighting. As with the earlier U.S. offensive, codenamed Iron Fist, it appeared many fighters may have slipped away beforehand. At least twice, illuminating flares went up over Haqqaniya, a sign U.S. troops were fighting the Iraqi resistance on the ground. American warplanes struck bridges, seeking to prevent fighters from escaping the towns, but arriving troops encountered dozens of roadside bombs on main avenues, apparently in anticipation of the operation, Marine commanders said. A single roadside bomb killed three U.S. service members, apparently among the first ground troops to move in. The U.S. military claimed that at least 41 insurgents have been killed in Operation Iron Fist. And from the New York Times, soldier reports more abuses to senator. An Army captain who has reported new allegations of detainee abuse in Iraq met Tuesday with Senator John McCain and staff aides on the House Armed Service Committee and gave them additional accounts of abuse in Iraq that other soldiers have sent him in recent days, congressional aides said. The officer, Captain Ian Fishback, in a brief interview after his half-hour meeting with Mr. McCain, declined to describe the new information he gave the senator or, in a separate meeting, two of the House aides. But Captain Fishback said that since he and two other former members of the 82nd Airborne Division last month accused soldiers in their battalion in Iraq of routinely beating and abusing prisoners in 2003 and 2004, several other soldiers have contacted him and asked him to relay to lawmakers their own experiences. In separate statements to Human Rights Watch, Captain Fishback and two sergeants recounted how members of the 1st Battalion, 504th Parachute Infantry, had repeatedly beaten Iraqi prisoners, exposed them to extremes of hot and cold, and stacked them in human pyramids at Camp Mercury, a forward operating base near Fallujah. The abuses reportedly took place between September 2003 and April 2004, before and during the abuses at the Abu Ghraib prison near Baghdad. And from the Associated Press, the Senate is to engage in a debate over detainees. The Senate will engage in a politically volatile debate over the U.S. military's treatment of terrorism suspects as fresh allegations of prisoner abuse surface and support bills for legislation to establish standards for handling detainees. Led by Senator John McCain of Arizona, a group of Republicans wants to have amendments imposing restrictions on the detention, interrogation, and prosecution of prisoners tacked onto the $440 billion military spending bill the Senate is to vote on. Senators offered the same proposals in the summer as the Senate worked on a bill setting Pentagon policy, but Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, Republican of Tennessee, scuttled that bill in part because of White House opposition. Undeterred, McCain, who was a prisoner of war in Vietnam, resurrected his legislation this week. His amendment would ban the use of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment against anyone in U.S. custody and require all U.S. troops to follow procedures in the Army Field Manual when they detain and interrogate suspects. As it did before, the White House last week threatened a veto over the proposal, arguing it would tie the president's hands during wartime. However, this time the administration did not send Vice President Dick Cheney to Capitol Hill to personally lobby McCain, Graham, and Senator John Warner, Republican of Virginia, the Senate Armed Service Committee chairman who supports the amendments. On Tuesday, McCain said, "I hope there is a realization that this is the right thing to do." At the same time, Democrats plan to continue to push their own proposal that would establish an independent commission to investigate allegations of prisoner abuse. The Pentagon already has done several of its own investigations and argues that another would be redundant. But Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, the top Democrat on the Armed Service Committee, said those reviews weren't thorough enough. "This is a rich target for a true investigation," he said Wednesday. McCain, Graham, and Warner decided that standards for handling detainees were needed in light of allegations of mistreatment at the Navy's Guantanamo Bay prison in Cuba and the abuse scandal at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Since July, a list of retired generals and admirals backing the effort has doubled from 14 to 28. In a letter last month, they said, "It is now apparent that the abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, and elsewhere took place in part because our men and women in uniform were given ambiguous instructions. Our service members were denied clear guidance and left to take the blame when things went wrong. They deserve better than that." In recent weeks, new claims of abuse and reminders of Abu Ghraib have been in the headlines. Human Rights Watch, a U.S. rights organization, reported that soldiers in the Army's elite 82nd Airborne Division systematically tortured Iraqi detainees in 2003 and 2004. The Pentagon says it's investigating. Last week, a federal judge in New York ordered the release of dozens more pictures of prisoners being abused at Abu Ghraib, rejecting government arguments that the images would provoke terrorists and incite violence against U.S. troops in Iraq. And our next story, by the Interpress Service. White House losing ground on prisoner treatment. Despite strong opposition from the Pentagon and the White House, the Republican leadership in the U.S. Senate is coming under growing pressure to set specific standards for the humane treatment of detainees taken in Iraq and elsewhere in the Bush administration's war on terror. Under orders from the administration, which last week repeated its threat to veto the entire $400 billion 2006 defense bill if the amendment was attached, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist has so far maneuvered to prevent them from coming to the floor for a vote. If adopted, the proposed amendments, whose co-sponsorship has grown to 11 Republican senators, would ban the use of, quote, "cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment, as defined by the U.S. Constitution, and any interrogation technique that is not authorized by the U.S. Army Field Manual, which was drafted to comply with the Geneva Conventions." The amendments have been endorsed by more than 24 retired flag-rank military officers, including a former chief of staff of the U.S. Armed Forces, General John Shalakashvili, the Bush administration's first Iraq occupation head, Lieutenant General Jay Garner, the highest-ranking legal officers for each of the armed services, as well as another former Vietnam POW and later U.S. ambassador to Vietnam, Pete Peterson. "The abuse of prisoners hurts America's cause in the war on terror, endangers U.S. service members who might be captured by the enemy, and is anathema to the values Americans have held dear for generations," the 28 retired generals and admirals wrote McCain this week. They called the Army manual, quote, "the gold standard for the, quote, effective, lawful, and humane treatment of prisoners." Two associates of the American Enterprise Institute, perhaps the Pentagon's single most enthusiastic defender of its refusal to apply the Geneva Conventions to suspected terrorists, added their voice in support of the amendments in an article published in the neoconservative Weekly Standard this week. They said, "The consequences of the failure to set a clear standard for the treatment of detainees are plain to see," wrote Thomas Donnelly and Vance Cerchuk, in an article entitled, "One Code to Rule Them All." They added, "We're not only making it easier for our enemies to hate us, but harder for our friends to love us." They went on to quote the letter from the retired officers, arguing that, "The net effect of the current Pentagon policy is that service members have been given conflicting instructions, then left to take the blame when things went wrong." The Pentagon has insisted that suspected terrorists captured in Afghanistan and elsewhere did not qualify as POWs who warranted the convention's protections. While the administration insisted that detainees would be treated humanely, they also authorized interrogation techniques that appeared to violate that standard, as a succession of investigations and leaks have shown. Unlike suspected terrorists, detainees arrested or captured in Iraq were supposed to be entitled to the convention's protections. But leaks, declassified documents, administrative hearings, and court-martials have shown that many of the techniques used in Afghanistan and Guantanamo migrated to Iraq. Indeed, the failure to set clear standards for the treatment of prisoners was the chief complaint of two anonymous sergeants and an Army captain, later identified as Captain Ian Fishback. Their testimony about routine abuses and often severe beatings of Iraqi detainees at a forward operating base near Fallujah was the subject of a recent Human Rights Watch report. He said, "My approach for clarification provides clear evidence that confusion over standards was a major contributor to the prisoner abuse, which included death threats, beatings, broken bones, murder, exposure to elements, extreme forced physical exertion, hostage-taking, stripping, sleep deprivation, and degrading treatment in both Afghanistan and Iraq, he wrote to McCain. It was only when Captain Fishback approached congressional offices last month that the Army, which initially tried to keep him confined to base, finally launched an investigation into his charges, although he has since complained that Army lawyers appear more interested in finding out the identity of the two sergeants who also talked with Human Rights Watch. And next we have excerpts of an article by Richard Chiasson, the ombudsman at the Boston Globe. His article is called Small Rally, Big Story. Big Rally, Small Story. In some parts of the nation, the gathering of more than 100,000 people on a Saturday afternoon would make for a good college football game, and one that gets plenty of media coverage. What about when a gathering of a similar size takes place in Washington, D.C. to protest against the war in Iraq? Last Sunday's Boston Globe tucked the story on page 6 with a photo, but without any mention on the front page. That was the first problem for many readers. Add to that the next day's rather prominent display of another rally by a much smaller group of pro-war demonstrators in Washington on page A2, the lead national news page for a weekday. Now you've got the ingredients for an onslaught of angry emails and phone calls. I'm flabbergasted at the relative amount of space given to the anti- and pro-war demonstrations, wrote Saul Rubin from Arlington. For those using the Globe as their main or only news source, the impression of what went on was vastly distorted. I expect better. Never mind whether Rubin or the dozens of other readers who lodged complaints last week are for or against the war in Iraq. His complaint against distortions is right. To be fair, the Globe's Sunday story on the larger anti-war protests was written by staff reporter Brian Bender and was longer, 830 words, than the Monday Associated Press story, 520. Such distinctions, among newspaper people anyway, mean that more thought was devoted to the coverage of the anti-war rally. But those differences are often too subtle for readers, who usually notice first where stories appear in the paper and how much space they were given. A protest involving 100,000 Americans, especially when it concerns a war that polls show most people now don't support, deserves better treatment. Ellen Clegg, the Globe's Sunday editor, explained that the anti-war rally had been considered for the front page, but that, quote, other stories were stronger. The story was instead given a mention atop the news index on page 2 and noted where the full article could be found inside. Readers would have been better served with something from the large rally, the story, photo, or mention on the front page. The New York Times, by comparison, provided a front page photo and a tease to a story inside, though it had no story in Monday's paper of the pro-war rally. Second, the size of the display, particularly the photo, of the much smaller pro-war demonstration in Monday's paper should have been reduced for a more balanced presentation of the two demonstrations, something National Affairs editor Kenneth Cooper acknowledged last week. So much for 2020 hindsight. But for the dozens of readers who contacted the ombudsman, I detected another message from Globe editors. Put the Iraq War back on the front page. Please bring the Iraq War coverage to where it belongs, said Debbie Carvelin of Brookline. This is something the whole country is experiencing, and it's been pushed too much to the side, and I don't want us to get complacent about what's happening there. The placement of stories is one way a newspaper gives readers a sense of what's important. If Globe readers are getting a message that the struggle in Iraq has become less of a priority, then the paper's editors should change that tune. And he ends by saying that the ombudsman represents the readers, his opinions and conclusions are his own. You can email him at ombud@globe.com.
To consecrate my office, my energies, and all the wisdom I can summon to the cause of peace among nations.
Now those who seek absolute power, even though they seek it to do what they regard as good, are simply demanding the right to enforce their own version of heaven on earth.
I want to thank Secretary Powell for his careful, powerful presentation of the facts.
A pack of lies. A pack of lies.
The United States government has, one way or another, ordered, authorized, permitted, tolerated, torture.
We're making tremendous progress, but there is much more to do to win the war on terrorism and defeat terrorism.
I have a dream. I have a dream.
The fact is, we do need better international governance to help spread the benefits of globalization.
American world domination, or paramountcy. Historically, the U.S. sought security, not domination.
Nothing's perfect in life, so you have an election that's not quite perfect. now was the time to come forward and say who specifically was on that energy task force and lift any kind of shadow that's still there.
We've been through this issue a number of times.
We need to make sure that the political, the economic, and the security infrastructure of that state is shaped and helped to come into being.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Abizaid and Casey told the president there's an increasing number of more capable Iraqi troops. This is good news. I'm sure that's also what they told the Armed Services Committee just 2 days earlier.
General Abizaid, there was a report sent over, I think last June, that three of the 100 Iraqi battalions were fully trained and equipped, capable of operating independently. What is that number now?
The number now is, if you're talking about level one trained, it's
yep.
One.
If one battalion.
You know, everyone was just like, oh yeah, how long have you been in Iraq? And I was like, no, I'm going to Afghanistan. You know, that's, I haven't been to Iraq yet.
And what was their reaction to that?
Their reaction is, oh, well, at least you'll be safe in Afghanistan. Yeah.
And it's not quite that way.
Oh, yeah, it's completely opposite.
Corporal Kyle Fredrickson spent a year in Iraq.
Everyone's like, oh, it's going to be worse. You could go to Iraq. But my experiences so far would indicate that I would rather be deployed back to Iraq than over here, personally.
My biggest mistake was not recognizing that Louisiana was dysfunctional.
But does that excuse fly? Does Brown really deserve blame for the tragically botched response to Katrina? Or is he merely a scapegoat? Victims, again and again.
Former FEMA Director Michael Brown told Congress this week he couldn't explain why they had to spend $200,000 at the last minute for body bags at the full price.
I don't know, and that was a mistake. One that we should look at and make sure we don't do in the future. We should have had the contract in place before Katrina made landfall.
The documents show FEMA was scrambling for ice, long an agency mainstay. Ice is used to keep medicine fresh and bodies from decomposing. But Michael Brown said he doesn't think providing ice is essential.
I don't think that's a federal government responsibility to provide ice to keep my hamburger meat in my freezer or refrigerator fresh.
According to an audit a year ago, FEMA's procurement office was a mess. Only one of 45 employees could document they had fulfilled the requirements to be a government purchaser.
Just 3 days after Hurricane Katrina struck, FEMA called up Carnival Cruise Lines and asked to lease three large cruise ships for 6 months to house evacuees. The price tag, a total of $236 million. The three ships, which is the sensation, the ecstasy, and the holiday, were to hold 7,100 evacuees. The problem is a lot of evacuees didn't want anything to do with cruise ships. They didn't want to get near the water, get on the water. And so these ships are not at all filled. It's unclear exactly how many evacuees are on these cruise ships right now. But Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn, Republican, has done some number crunching, and here's what he got. Even if 7,100 evacuees were on the ship, in other words, even if they were filled to capacity, the price would be over $1,200 a week. And here's the rub. If you wanted to book a cruise, you could do it for about $600 a week. So here is the government at work overpaying. It certainly looks as if they're overpaying. Now, Carnival Cruise responds by saying they're going to lose money on this deal, that they had to cancel 100,000 trips on the ships, and they won't even break even. But
They're losing money on it. How much did you say the total cost was?
The total is $236
And they're
million.
Losing dough.
They say they're losing money.
And they don't even have to figure. And they're just sitting there in dock. They're
yes.
not even moving them around.
Yep. Yeah.
I don't get that.
No, it's hard to figure, but this is just another deal that FEMA is going to have to do more explaining about.
Well, the notion that it has anything to do with free trade is ridiculous unless he's interested in trading in misery, because that's exactly what's happening here. You are kicking people who have been devastated when they're down, workers who've lost their homes, even family members, obviously their jobs, And they should be the first ones put back to work once the reconstruction begins. And what Davis-Bacon does is it allows, again, contractors to make a profit off of the misery of others. The reality is that they've suspended the contracting requirements for women and minority-owned businesses. And what rescinding the Davis-Bacon wage guarantees does is it allows out-of-state and large contractors like the Halliburtons of the world to come in, import labor from other states, and undercut the local wages and pay as little wage as possible.
And for the ninth year in a row, Congress has failed to pass the spending bills needed to keep the federal government operating. So today, the Senate approved a stopgap funding measure that keeps the government in business until mid-November. Funding levels will remain unchanged for most programs, but social safety net funds for the poorest Americans are being cut in half.
This money goes out quarterly. It's used quarterly. It means that tomorrow, the community services block grants will be cut 50%. Not next year, tomorrow, in real dollars. This isn't some phony baloney stuff.
Look, we sent inspectors from the Office of Weights and Measures in the Division of Consumer Affairs in our office out to visually observe what was going on and to document it. Not only were some of these stations raising prices 3, 4, 5 times in a single day, but when we asked them for the documentation, which the law requires that they keep, they didn't keep the documentation. They didn't have it to show to us. And that's on top of some of these stations that, again, advertised one price and charged the second one to the pumps.
What will be the impact should you prevail against these oil companies?
Well, the fines in these statutes are not great, and certainly you can't fine an oil company enough to really hurt them. The goal here is to stop the practice.
Particularly not with the current profits.
Well, that's correct. The goal here is to stop the practices in these particular stations, stop other stations from doing it, and to try to get some restitution.
But I do know that it's true that if you wanted to reduce crime, you could, if that were your sole purpose, you could abort every black baby in this country and your crime rate would go down. That would be an impossible, ridiculous, and morally reprehensible thing to do, but your crime rate would go down.
I think they're blatantly racist. I think that even after he had said to kill people based on who they are is morally reprehensible, he then came back and stated as a fact that if you did do this, even if it was reprehensible, it would in fact lower the crime rate, which clearly is he making blacks and crime synonymous. So I think even after he recovered, he re-emphasized the offensive point in the first place, and he seems to be oblivious to what he has said out of his own mouth and then confirmed after he tried to clean it up.
Many of the debt experts are saying this is the perfect storm. This is a disaster for middle America.
But Katrina was so massive that it overwhelmed the Red Cross, which is why the Florida Boulevard Baptist Church in Baton Rouge has been housing relief workers for weeks at great expense. The pastor welcomes FEMA's financial assistance.
We just don't see it as an offense. Basically, we see that, you know, churches are changing the oil and the government can help change the tires. And if we can work together, we can get the job done.
But critics say FEMA's reimbursement plan has no safeguards to prevent taxpayer dollars from subsidizing attempts to convert people who are in a very vulnerable state.
There's a very real risk that you could be reimbursed for prayer, Bible reading, a variety of religious activities, some of which are designed to convert you from whatever you were into whatever that particular church wants you to be.
And the God of peace will be with you.
Advocates of church-state separation are steaming.
You simply can't dump money into a church collection plate and say, well, you did some good work. We won't even ask the question whether you also used this money to try to convert people to your religious beliefs.
On October 14th, as many as 3,000 city employees will receive their last paycheck.
The problem we're having is that we have no revenue streams.
The city is still trying to determine how to send the pink slips. They can't send them in the mail because there is no mail service in New Orleans. And even if there were, most city workers evacuated and are now living in other places.
The ones who are being retained, I would imagine, know it.
I'm hearing a lot of things that some people are not coming back, so.
Even when it's over.
Right.
I don't know how all this big money works whenever whenever it comes down. It's, you know, we're supposed to be getting all this funding and everything, but now we got to lay off a lot of people who have already lost their homes and stuff like that, so it's sad.
It is not what residents in this region expect to return to. Local leaders here are now begging Washington for the money they need to keep their governments alive.
A lethal strain that's killed roughly five dozen people in Asia, with no confirmed cure, no fully developed vaccine, has the president openly discussing worst-case scenarios. What if the avian flu spread to the United States?
If we had an outbreak somewhere in the United States, do we not then quarantine that part of the country? And how do you then enforce a quarantine? One option is the use of a military that's able to plan and move.
And what about this idea that President Bush was talking about yesterday of bringing military in and quarantining a geographic area of a country if you see an outbreak?
Well, it's really a very sensible thing, I think, for a head of state to be indicating that this is a possibility so that the people are prepared and start talking about it.
That was news excerpts compiled by Zapping the Empire. If you want to hear the rest of that piece, you can find it at radioforall.net. Next, we have excerpts from the Citizens Tribunal on Iraq.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week on the program, we aired an extended report on the federal trial of four Ithaca area peace activists known as the St. Patrick's Day Four. For those who've not yet heard, the following day, the jury in Binghamton returned a verdict of not guilty on the felony conspiracy charges, a big relief as those were the most severe. However, the jury convicted the four on misdemeanor charges of damage of government property and entering for illegal purposes. These convictions put four of Ithaca's finest citizens at risk of spending as much as 18 months in prison. A circumstance that outrages me, especially because an array of highly placed war criminals, liars, and racketeers, in other words, the federal government, face no consequences but bad opinion polls. Sentencing of the four will take place in January. The district attorney has great latitude as to whether to bring a case to trial and what charges to lay against a defendant. Since the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, Dente's office has had a pattern of charging peace activists with the most severe charge remotely possible, then offering a plea bargain, a strategy apparently designed to maintain the 95% conviction rate which Dente cites as evidence of his excellent job performance. This tactic failed to work against the St. Patrick's Four, who refused a plea bargain and went to trial. John Sherman, a locally elected judge, allowed the four to fully present their reasons for action and their belief that international laws against war crimes not only justified it, but required it. The defendants believe that had they had a similar opportunity in federal court, the jury would have responded in a similar fashion. Supporters of the St. Patrick's Day Four decided to focus a national spotlight on the issues of Iraq that motivated the defendants and organized a week-long citizens' tribunal. I promise to bring those sessions to you, and tonight we will hear the first panel, made up of two Americans and one Briton, all who served the establishment for decades, but broke ranks over the Iraq War. The panel was moderated by James Petras, Professor Emeritus of Binghamton University, and an internationally regarded political analyst and author. His voice is the first you will hear.
We are meeting here in this tribunal to deal with issues of paramount importance that go far beyond the borders of this city, of this country. What are the issues that we face here? There are two versions. The versions that the federal trial will try to confine the defendants to, and the issues that will be raised at this parallel citizens' tribunal. According to the government, the St. Patrick's Four are charged with conspiracy, criminal trespass, and intimidation of federal officers carrying out duties. The response to that is there's no conspiracy. It was a public act of civil disobedience. There was no intimidation unless sending a divine message of peace can be interpreted as evoking the wrath of heaven on the warmakers. Nothing of the sort. We must not let the federal court trivialize what is at stake here. According to many international jurists, the issues here include the unilateral declaration of an offensive war by the Bush administration against the UN Charter and international law, deliberate falsification of data presented as the pretext for war, willful deception of the sovereign people of the United States and its military forces as to the causes and consequences of the Iraq War, a systematic rejection of diplomatic means and methods designed to find a peaceful resolution to the alleged conflict with a defenseless country, engaging in a war resulting in crimes against humanity, including the death of over 100,000 Iraqis, pursuing a series of wars that willfully and deliberately increase the vulnerability of the United States and its allies to terrorism and natural disasters, accompanying the war with profound disregard for democratic freedoms enshrined in the Constitution, as evidenced in the Patriot Act and derivative judicial rulings allowing for the indeterminate jailing of U.S. citizens without charges, pursuing war through executive rulings which explicitly flaunt the Geneva Convention prohibiting torture and cruel and inhuman treatment of prisoners. Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo will go down in the infamous chapters of American history. Prioritizing military responses and definitions of political conflicts and reducing diplomatic responses to post hoc efforts to justify the unjustifiable. By making a shambles of diplomacy, Washington has established a precedent for other countries to shoot first and talk later. Notions of total war, unending wars, collective punishment, occupation and colonization are the ideological constructs of neoconservative advocates of world empire who place no limits on the sacrifice of U.S. lives at home and overseas. The issues raised by the St. Patrick Four are questions of whether we can reject the blind alley of endless wars and embrace a peaceful resolution of world conflicts based on justice, freedom, and self-determination of all peoples. We have with us tonight Ray McGovern, an ex-CIA man of 27 years, working now with justice groups in the United States. We have Anne Wright, former Foreign Service officer, who had the courage to resign on March 19, 2003, to protest the invasion of Iraq and the violation. Yes, she had the courage to walk out, to say no, basta, up to here, no more. And we have Michael Meacher, a former Minister of the Environment between 1997 and 2003 in the British government of Tony Blair. They say Blair or Blair or Blyer. And a former Member of Parliament in England. Current member. Wonderful. It's even better. We have a current member of Parliament with us this evening. Ray McGovern.
Let me start out by just saying a word about veteran intelligence professionals for sanity. Anne is one of our distinguished members. We have about 50 now from all agencies of the government having to do with intelligence. We chose the word sanity purposely because the people running our policy toward the Middle East displayed nothing of this quality. As a matter of fact, they were known in the 80s as, quote, the crazies, universally referred to in high government circles as the crazies who needed to be kept at middle levels. These are the Pearls, these are the Wolfowitzes, kept at middle levels so they wouldn't destroy the house. We could see what was happening. So we formed our group in January of 2003. We were very upset because, you know, believe it or not, the coin of the realm in the intelligence analysis business is to speak truth without fear of favor. We had career protection for telling it like it is. It was a real high. And you know, we could go down to Henry Kissinger, as I was often sent down to, and tell him what we thought, even if it was 180 degrees from what we thought. We wrote three memoranda before the war. The first was a same-day critique of Colin Powell's speech at the UN. We gave him an A for performance, a C minus for content, and if we knew then what we know now, of course, we would have flunked him outright. It was a no-brainer. Where were the weapons of mass destruction? The U.S. was said to be giving its best evidence to the UN inspectors. The UN inspectors were implementing the most rigorous inspection regime in the history of the world, and they were finding nothing. No WMDs. Oops. They did find a couple of missiles that exceeded the range allowed. Do you remember that? That was in January of 2003. What happened? Anyone? What happened to those missiles? They were destroyed. They were destroyed before the UN inspectors. So it seems that Saddam Hussein was doing his part. But none could be found. Rumsfeld, of course, said, we know where they are. They're around Baghdad, Tikrit, north, east, south, and west of there. You know. This is the same guy that said, this has nothing to do with oil. And the same fellow who said that the ties between Al-Qaeda and the regime in Iraq were bulletproof. While Scowcroft, General Scowcroft, was saying that they were very tenuous indeed. So, what was the answer? Why we couldn't find any weapons of mass destruction? Well, obviously, they're very good at hiding things. So, the notion that they might not be there didn't occur to our leaders. Why? Well, because they had other reasons for this war. Now, the press, to my great regret, and this is the big sea change in my 40 years of watching things in Washington closely, we no longer have in any real sense a free press. The press led the cheerleading for the war, as you'll know. They gave the cowardly Colin high marks for his speech. They took everything that the White House gave them and published it on the first page of the New York Times and the Washington Post, a far cry from the days of the 70s in Watergate. What was the evidence that was adduced then? Well, when the administration top officials came back from summer vacation in 2002, they had already shared with our British colleagues the fact that there was going to be a war, that it would be, quote, justified by the conjunction of weapons of mass destruction, which there weren't any of, and ties with terrorists, which there are no ties, no matter. When the British foreign minister said, yes, but the evidence on weapons of mass destruction is thin, his word, thin, the head of British intelligence says, no problem. The evidence, the intelligence and the facts are being fixed around the policy. This is in black and white. You know, this is the Downing Street minutes. So no longer was there any doubt this was going to happen. The question was how to do it. And I wasn't in the Oval Office, but I can just visualize how the conversation went. You know, Labor Day is passed now, and okay, we're going to have this war. So what we need to do? Let's get it going. Well, Mr. President, there's this Constitution thing. Constitution thing? What do you mean? Well, literally speaking, the power to declare or to authorize war is limited to the elected representatives of the people in the Congress and not you, sir. Well, okay. I guess we better do what my dad did and persuade the Congress. How are we going to do that? Well, they had no evidence, folks. All they had were a couple of aluminum tubes that were for mortar rockets or artillery rockets. And they had this story about Iraq seeking uranium in the African country of Niger. Now, when that story came in, my former colleagues in CIA dismissed it outright. Why? Because the government of Niger doesn't control the uranium mine in Niger. It's controlled by an international consortium headed by the French, and every ounce of that stuff is accounted for. There ain't no way that could happen. Ambassador Wilson went down there, verified all that. Still, the story lived. Still, the story lived. And that story was used. That story was used with our elected representatives in the Senate and the House of Representatives to trick our Congress out of their constitutional prerogative to declare war and then make them authorize this war. Don't take my word for this. Read the letter that Henry Waxman wrote to the president before the war. You see, it was clear that it was based on a forgery before the war. So what we have here really is two things. We have a report that's false on its face, and then we learned later it's based on a forgery. The thing that comes to mind is, some of you are too young to remember Yul Brynner in The King and I. Remember that famous line where he sits back and he says, "So, it's a false lie." That's what we had here, a false lie. Well, folks, the laughter stops when you realize this false lie was used with Congress to get them to vote for war. Henry Waxman wrote a letter to the president, a bitter letter to the president, in which he said, "Mr. President, I voted for this war on the basis of your people briefing me about this report that Iraq was seeking uranium in Niger. How do you explain this? How do you explain that that this could happen?" Guess what the date of that letter was, folks? March 17th, 2003. We, veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, issued our third memorandum to the president on March 17th, 2003, the title of which was "Forgery, Hyperbole, and Half-Truth. You've got a problem, Mr. President." Again, 2 days before the war. Sort of interesting, isn't it, how everything seems to happen on a good St. Patrick's Day. Suffice it to say that we were doing our part. Waxman was writing to the president in his letter. We wrote our memorandum to the president. But the St. Patrick's Four were doing something much more valuable. Because Martin Luther King, in his famous letter from the Birmingham City Jail, makes it clear that there comes a time when you have to put your flesh and blood into it to sensitize the conscience of the nation. And that's what you all did, you St. Patrick's Four, by taking your own blood, spilling it in a prominent place where you could serve a warning, serve a witness, saying, "Look, you may get upset about blood on the steps. Why are you not upset about so much blood that you could foresee happening in Iraq? 100,000 civilians would be alive today in Iraq were it not for this war. And of course, you know, we've reached 1,900 U.S. men and women killed in that war. So what I see is a prophetic statement by the St. Patrick's Four. And I think that is an example of how one can speak out for justice. One can speak out not only against the horrors of war in and of itself, the brutalization that has accompanied this war, the torture. I just have to say that I thought torture would be one thing that all Americans could agree on. It's just never, never permitted. I mean, torture, in my view, is in the same category as rape, as slavery. Never mind that it doesn't work. As an intelligence officer, I know that. Never mind that it gives the country a black eye or that it puts our own soldiers at risk. It's just wrong, folks. And why our churches, for example, cannot find their voice Why? I just have to say that I am really in awe of what the Catholic Worker does, not only in its ministrations to the less fortunate, its speaking with authority on matters of justice, and I'm referring to biblical justice now, biblical justice, which is not unbiased, which is hopelessly prejudiced in favor of the poor. We have this in America. We have this... We have this symbol for justice, don't we? It's a blindfolded woman with scales, so she can't see which way to tip. You know, okay. Well, the biblical concept is like that, in favor of the poor. The actual pre-Aramaic word for justice, tzedakah, has in its denotation showing mercy to the poor. So be aware that this biblical justice stuff is an anti-American activity, folks. Okay. And when you look at what the Vietnam War... Yeah, the Vietnam War delivered the war on poverty. Stillborn. Those of us around remember that, and we can see the same thing happening with the extraordinary expenditures being put on this feckless war in Iraq. So, following this example of Dorothy Day, the Catholic Worker stays engaged, informed, readers of the signs of the times, and they followed the pre-war charade and saw through the disingenuousness of our government's statements, and did their deed, for which I am in great admiration. And I think it no accident that St. Patrick, looking down from his new perch, must have thought in 2003, well, I wonder what kind of a day I'm going to have today. There'll be a nice parade in Dublin, and the friendly sons of St. Patrick in New York will be whooping it up. But I wonder what kind of a day this will be for justice. Well, I think he's real happy. Not so much with Waxman's letter or our VIPS memo. I think he'd be really happy at the witness for justice that the St. Patrick's Four have given. A prophetic act. Now, how can I be so sure? Well, Americans don't read much anymore, but if one reads Paul O'Neill's memoirs, Richard Clark's memoirs, one can see that weapons of mass destruction had nothing to do with the war in Iraq, that it was those were all disingenuous explanations. And one could see that well before the documentary evidence that is available to us now in the Downing Street memos. So where does this leave us? Well, it leaves me really angry. Aquinas had a lot of things wrong, like the status of women, but he got some things very right. And when he talked about virtue, he was right on the nose. He was very upset that there was no word in Latin for the virtue of anger, okay? The virtue of anger. He said, the word for anger, manati nominata, remains unnamed. And he quoted John Chrysostom from the early church, who said, he or she who is not angry when there is just cause for anger sins, okay? Why? Because anger... Because anger looks to the good of justice, and if you can live amid injustice without anger, you are unjust. That's what Chrysostom said, and Aquinas added this. He railed against what he called unreasoned patience. Now, that's the best we can do out of the Latin, unreasoned patience. But think about what that might mean, unreasoned patience. Aquinas said, unreasoned patience sows the seeds of vice, nourishes negligence, and encourages not only evil people, but good people to do evil. So, what do you think of first when you think of unreasoned patience? Well, I think of Germany in 1939 and earlier in the 30s. I was born in 1939, 1 week before Hitler set his tanks into Poland to start World War II, and I have a certain bizarre affinity for that year. I've also lived in Germany for 5 years and had all manner of opportunity to ask the Germans why it was. Why was it? How could it have been that you, among the most cultured, the most educated people in the Western world, how could you have let this happen? How could you not find your voice? Why is it that your churches, the Evangelical Lutheran Church, your Catholic churches, why is it they said nothing? I never got a good answer to that. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, of course, was one that did speak out and was killed. But there was another gentleman that you may not know about, and I'd like to just tell his story very briefly before closing. His name was Albrecht Haushofer, and he was a geologist at the University of Berlin. Those of you who have tenure know what tenure is like. He had a pretty good deal there, and he didn't speak out before the war, but when Hitler started invading other countries, he spoke out strongly, often was wrapped up and sent to prison like Bonhoeffer. Now, the SS, in typically German methodical practice, was required to extract a confession from people before they shot him or before they hanged him, but Haushofer wouldn't cooperate. They shot him anyway, and when they picked him off the floor, out of his pocket fell a little piece of paper, and it was his confession, and it was written in the form of a sonnet. The title was Schuld, which is the German word for guilt. Doch bin ich schuldig, aber anders als ihr denkt. Yeah? I'm guilty, but it's not what you're thinking. Ich musste früher meine Pflicht erkennen. Ich musste schärfer Unheil, Unheil nennen. I should have earlier recognized my duty. I should have schärfer, more sharply, called Unheil, called evil, evil. Mein Urteil habe ich zu lang gelenkt. My judgment I put off far too long. Ich habe gewarnt, I did warn, aber nicht genug und klar. Genug is enough. Klar, claro, klar. There's no comparative in German for klar. Klar is klar. Okay, clear. So, nicht genug und klar. Und heute weiß ich, was ich schuldig war. And today, I recognize what I was guilty of. I think we need to ponder those words because, as Martin Luther King said in his famous speech on Vietnam, there is such a thing as too late. There is such a thing as too late. And to further challenge us and to show in the light of the St. Patrick's Four that it is possible to measure up, let me quote the words of a poet I know named Daniel Berrigan. We have assumed the name of peacemakers, but we have been, by and large, unwilling to pay any significant price. And because we want peace with half a heart, half a life, half a will, the war, of course, continues. He's talking Vietnam. Because the waging of war, by its very nature, is total. But the waging of peace, by our own cowardice, is partial. So a whole will and a whole heart and a whole national life bent toward war prevail over the vaities of peace. Of course, let us have peace, we cry. But at the same time, let us have normalcy. Let us lose nothing. Let our lives stand intact. Let us know neither prison, no ill repute, no disruption of ties. There is no peace because there are no peacemakers. There are no makers of peace because the making of peace is at least as costly as the making of war, at least as exigent, at least as liable to bring disgrace and prison and even death in its wake. I will close with a quote that reminds me of a couple of things. I think it's originated with Dante, but it says that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who remain neutral in times of crisis. I think we have a crisis moment here. I think it is also what we would say is a Kairos moment. And I would just warn about, you know, those of us who have been in Crawford, Texas this past August, I understand that hell is even hotter than Crawford. Thank you very much.
Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern.
We will continue in the second half of our show with more excerpts from the Citizens Tribunal.